This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in to our Week in Review, a survey of important news from all over the world. There's so much going on in the world, so much to attract your attention and to occupy your time. People are consuming information at a record pace, but how much of it really matters? How much of it will have an impact in the long run? I was reading an article about time management, and it gave this advice: stop consuming the news or reading the newspaper. And I thought, well, what? But the point that this article was making was that so many sources of news just feed what arrests your eyeballs. They just are trying to grab your attention, whether or not it has any real value. And it basically said, unplug from those news sources and make sure that the news that you're getting is high-quality news of real consequence. Now, this might sound like bragging, but there is no better source of high-quality news of real consequence than the Trumpet. Our staff scours events and trends. We separate the wheat from the chaff. We work hard to avoid the nonsense and just bring you what really does matter. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Robert Morley.
Good morning.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
Brent Noctegal.
Good to be here.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
For many weeks, our top story has been a major trend in world news. Russia's moves, the immigration crisis in Europe, Germany's leadership vacuum, war in Syria, Iran's rise, and so on and so forth. But today we're going to step back and look at some recent events in the United States. And in one sense, this might look a lot less important than some of those global trends, but it is going to prove to be a bigger and bigger story over time. We want to talk about racism at Missouri University. A couple of weeks ago, a graduate student said that he was going to go on a hunger strike until the president of the university, Tim Wolf, resigned. Now, there have been charges of racism on the campus at Mizzou. The student wrote, "Students are not able to achieve their full academic potential because of the inequalities and obstacles they face." He said the president wasn't doing enough to address these problems. Well, other students agreed with him, and then 32 players on the university's football team started to boycott practices and games, trying to force the president to step down. Well, on Monday, that's just what this man did. Stephen Fleury addressed this on his Trumpet Daily program on Tuesday, and today his article is online at thetrumpet.com, University of Missouri, where racism merges with violent youth culture. It's the cover story also on this week's edition of the Trumpet Weekly. This is our free weekly digest of the news of the week. I just want to read a quote from his article here. He talks about a participant in the campus protests at Mizzou telling the Associated Press that he felt liberated by President Tim Wolf's ouster. He also participated in a, quote, die-in protest in memory of Michael Brown, the black teenager shot by a white police officer in Ferguson. He said, "That was the first time I got involved in activism. I've never felt that unity before, that kind of energy. It was very empowering. And it planted the seeds that students can challenge things." He quotes another student protester inspired by Ferguson who said, "This is something I wish had been happening here my entire tenure. I think universities should be bastions for this." A lot of people are saying this is great. Students realizing they have the power to make change. They're demanding, for example, a 10% increase in black faculty positions on campus. Now, it's highly ironic, to say the least, that the football team would be demanding proportional representation based on race. Let's see how well a football team does if it has a predetermined percentage of whites and Asians and Latinos as well as blacks. Now, in sports, you make the team if you can play well. You earn your position based on your merits, on your skills, not on your race, and it wouldn't work any other way. But anyway, there are people who are praising these students for what they accomplished here, and it's amazing to me just thinking about this, how the accomplishments that you see, quote-unquote accomplishments in situations like this, are always destructive. It's getting someone fired. It's shutting something down. It's never about achieving actual harmony or making things more peaceful or improving the state of race relations or building something. And the reason is that that isn't their goal. Their goal is really destruction. And in this case, we had students here chanting, "It is our duty to fight for our freedom. We have nothing to lose but our chains." On Tuesday's program, Mr. Fleury actually played tape of them chanting this. And that quote, what they were chanting, is that it's actually a quote from a fugitive cop killer, one of the FBI's most wanted terrorists, Assata Shakur. And the woman who led that chant has said, "We're trying to break the system down. It just so happens that we're starting with him, this university president." That's their real goal. They want to break the system. Robert Morley, your thoughts on this?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind to me is just how much that rhetoric is so similar to the types of rhetoric we hear coming from some of the highest offices and positions within the land. It's that rhetoric about how American society is racist, how it's a white capitalist society that's holding down minorities, and that to reverse that and to free and to liberate minorities from the shackles of the white system, basically it needs to be overthrown. It reminds me a lot about Van Jones. If you remember Van Jones being the green energy czar that was brought into prominence during President Obama's first term. And Glenn Beck talked a lot about that. We wrote a lot about Van Jones at the time and his beliefs and how he was so vocal about having the system needing to be overthrown because it was a white-dominated system. And it's that same sort of rhetoric that we're seeing in the university student protesters today. And we're seeing that it's gaining a lot of power, even though in many of these universities, they're a minority group. When you can compare the numbers of protesters that are out there, the media gives them huge coverage because they are so militant, because they are so radical, because their demands are so extreme in many cases. But when you put them in context of how many students are actually in these colleges, you can just see how much damage they are doing, the smaller group is doing in these colleges.
Yeah, in this case, say the students who were on the football team, it was actually it was about a quarter of the team, but it was enough of the players there that they got what they wanted.
Well, yeah, absolutely, right? The total football team, 86 members on the team, most of those were not supportive of these protests. The staff, the coaching were not supportive of this. But that small group was able to make the president capitulate and resign. And it shows how much power sports has in universities. It made the college millions of dollars. But I think it also brings out another important point that we have to remember about our college system today. Why did the president resign so quickly? Why was he forced out? Well, remember, college presidents, their job today isn't to educate students. That's not their job. That's the way it was originally when colleges were founded in the United States. Today, the president's job of most colleges is a fundraiser. That's his job. He needs to bring in money to the college. A huge proportion of his itinerary, daily itinerary, is going to fundraisers, meeting people, meeting the movers and shakers that can bring in revenue and advertising for the colleges. And so he's kind of the chief cheerleader of the college. So they needed this issue to disappear because it was bad press for their college. And, you know, looking at the protesters' demands, a lot of them were like, you know, these vague accusations of racism and, oh, some one student here did this thing over here. So far from everything I can tell, there was no widespread, the evidence for being widespread racism on the college, unless you believe the whole city the whole system is inherently racist. There wasn't a lot of this evidence, not a lot that most rational people would say, okay, this guy needs to resign. This college president did not do enough to tackle this problem that was endemic through the university.
It's difficult not to view this in light of the event that just happened at Yale, where you had essentially you had a college administrator, I think it was the dean of the of Yale, he sent this email out saying, well, make sure that when you're out there with your Halloween costumes, that you wear costumes that aren't going to offend offend other people. And you know, he's not talking about sexually suggestive costumes or like grotesque costumes. He's talking about culturally insensitive costumes like a feathered headdress or a turban or war paint. And he says, you know, this these types of costumes threaten our sense of community. And so you had another another official at the college send out an email in response, a very well-reasoned email that basically said, is it really the job of university officials to decide these matters? You know, we should trust the students enough to allow them to make these decisions. And if somebody is offended by a costume, you know, go up and tell the person. I don't appreciate that. But when that second email went out, the students just flipped out and they accused her of saying, well, you're saying that it's okay to dress like an Indian or a Muslim for Halloween. Don't you realize how outrageous this is? And eventually, it ended up with these students just shouting her husband down in the public square and just cursing him out and just throwing a major tantrum and demanding that these people be fired. It's hard not to get this sense of that these students have no sense of proportion in the way that they're overreacting to situations like this. Is there genuine racism in a situation like that? If an administrator is trying to actually defend the right of a student to make a decision about something so minor, you have students in this situation. There was one of these students who they wrote in their school paper let me see if I can find this. I have friends who are not going to class, who are not doing their homework, who are losing sleep, who are skipping meals, and who are having breakdowns because of an email.
Yeah, grow up. I mean, this is a real world we live in. If you aren't going to be able to handle a costume in life, you're not going to be able to succeed in any aspect of your life. So it's time, I think, a lot of these university students start realizing that, yeah, they live in a real world and that, you know, their mommy and daddy isn't going to be able to come and hold their hands and make them feel better every time that somebody offends them.
Well, you know, it there is that, but there's also the militant sense of grievance that has been fostered in their minds and this sense of victimization, even as they are bullying those in authority and getting them fired and really demonstrating a tremendous amount of political power. They're acting like they're the victims.
Yeah, and never mind these issues of free speech and the First Amendment, right? Freedom of speech. Here they are. They're wanting to, sure, somebody's dressing in costume. Maybe that's insensitive. Maybe that offends them. But we don't live in a culture we don't live in a society that censors free speech. And there's a reason the founders of the United States built that into the Constitution. It was to prevent tyranny. It was to prevent people from, you know, speech tyrannists from coming out there and deciding what people can and cannot say. I mean, that's very dangerous. You know, that's why the media is protected. And in these protests, we saw, you know, there was that one faculty member that came out and was saying, hey, we don't want the cameras here. And she was calling in muscle to get the journalists out of here. We don't want them to see what's going on. And that's dangerous. And it's astounding that in academia of all places, of the universities of all places, you'd see that kind of intolerance.
Right. Intolerance in the name of tolerance. Well, before we move on, Rob, maybe you could give us an overview of any other headlines from Anglo-America.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. A couple of items for us today. First, as President Obama is nearing the end of his presidential term, there's a new poll out that finds that voters are disapproving of his handling of nearly every issue, whether it's the economy, healthcare, environment, or a host of other issues. More voters disapprove of how Obama is handling the issues than approve. And according to Breitbart, the breadth of issues where President Obama is upside down with voters is unprecedented. unprecedented. What I found interesting about this, though, is that people in general like President Obama as a person. He has a strong majority of respondents that say they actually like him as a person. And the one issue that he does have approval of, the majority of people, is on gay rights. Actually, a large majority of people have approved his handling of great gay rights issues. Another item I have is that, and I'm talking about approval of government leaders, is that Congress's approval is also at a 41-year low, and a new Gallup poll reveals that 86% of Americans disapprove of Congress, and that ties a 41-year record for such negative sentiments. Just a tiny 11% of the respondents actually approve of lawmakers. And get this, this includes 8% of Republicans, 13% of independents, and 11% of Democrats. So actually more Democrats approve of Congress than Republicans approve of Congress. And this isn't typically the way it works. Gallup said this wasn't unprecedented, but it was certainly out of the ordinary.
11% approval rating, that's right up there with Kim Jong-un, I think. So you're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to transition now to the Middle East. And Brent, let's start with the overview of the headlines.
Iraqi Kurdish fighters today, the famous Peshmerga, they took control of the town of Sinjar in Iraq. There was American air cover at the start, and then their troops came in and wrested this town away from the Islamic State. This was the town that had the Yazidi Christians in it. We heard about that a couple of years ago, but now that town is back under the control of the Kurds. And then another item, the European Union yesterday, or 2 days ago, they approved guidelines for its member states to label products made in the West Bank settlements. No longer does everything coming out of Israel have the stamp "Made in Israel." If it's going to Europe, it must say "Made in the West Bank." And to see who likes this, Hamas, they came out and said it was a good first step towards progress in the peace talks and such in Palestine.
All right, and your top story.
Well, yesterday and the day before, EU leaders were in Malta for a summit. And this summit, there they determined to give African nations a bunch of cash to increase development in their own countries to hopefully try and stem the tide of refugees. The theory being if they make their countries more livable and more opportunity, have more opportunities there, they won't come into Europe. Well, at the end of this meeting, the EU leaders, they hung around to talk about a bigger problem with Turkey. Now, currently, Turkey holds more than 2 million Syrian nationals and is the main transit point, as we've talked about already, for refugees entering Europe from Syria. Just as an example, 666,000 refugees have landed in Greece this year from Turkey, and that's about 500,000 more that have landed in Italy from North Africa. So it's huge. The problem in Turkey and into Greece is so much bigger than what's coming out of North Africa. And what we're seeing is this focus move from Europe to focus on Turkey because they realize they are the main culprit here. And if they're going to stop people from entering Fortress Europe, the strongest gatekeeper they have is Turkey and its leader, Erdogan. So at that meeting following in Malta, they reaffirmed a plan that Turkey was going to receive $3 billion to set up camps inside Turkey to stop these people from entering Greece. Now, this amount is quite substantial. Initially, it was $1 billion that Turkey was going to get, but now it's $3 billion. And the reason is it's because Turkey knows, and strong leader Erdogan knows, that it has Europe over a barrel with this. Europe sees, though, that Turkey, that Erdogan really is the only leader in Turkey that is strong enough to actually affect change. So it wants Erdogan to stay in power so that it can do this deal. Now, that's why what I'd like to focus on for the remaining time is just to show how Germany has positioned Erdogan to be the leader of that country. They've done some uncharacteristic things in the past couple of months in order that Erdogan would stay in power. Our listeners will remember that in June, there was an election inside Turkey and Erdogan missed out on getting a majority in that. And the other groups weren't able to form a government. So what he did is he said, well, we're going to have new elections and they're going to take place in November. So in the lead up to this vote on November 1st, we have a couple of instances where Germany and Europe have inserted themselves into the political process to ensure that Erdogan stays in power. The first thing that they did was a special visit by Chancellor Angela Merkel to Istanbul just 2 weeks out from the election. Now, the German media went mad at this. You do not visit a foreign country on the eve of an election. That will influence the vote, even in Turkey. She stood alongside Erdogan's party leader and said that we need to restart talks for EU membership. We're going to loosen visa requirements for Turkish citizens to travel into the EU. And none of these steps were considered until this refugee crisis developed. They also offered that there was going to be further steps for Turkey to come into the EU. So this was a pretty big deal. You don't do this. German media said, what in the world is she doing in there in Turkey? Does she want Erdogan to remain in power? A lot of people in Turkey, they are all for a strengthening relationship with Europe. There's 4 million Turks inside Germany that could vote on this election. They are for closer relationships between Germany and Europe. So this was going to influence the vote. The second thing that's in the Trumpet Weekly even this week is that the annual European Commission progress report on Turkey was delayed till after the election. This was meant to come out a week before the election, and it was going to talk about the human rights abuses that Erdogan has made against his people. It was going to talk about the media smackdown that Erdogan gave to other political parties, anyone that would speak out against Erdogan. This was going to lambaste him for that, and they delayed this till after the election as well. And again, Germany and Europe, other people in Germany, they were like, what is Europe doing? This is a dictator. We are meant to be the beacon of Western values, of democratic values. We have the moral high ground here. And yet, Germany was willing to swing the election in Erdogan's favor so that it could get some results in the refugee crisis. Merkel sacrificed her principled position regarding democracy and human rights for the imperative of geopolitics. This is something that we haven't seen from Europe for a while, that they would sacrifice their core values to ensure that a dictator stays in power so that they would end at the end of the day, something would benefit them.
Really fascinating. You know, it's this whole time that it's been decades that Turkey has been trying to get into the EU, and it has been the fact that they are a predominantly Muslim nation that has prevented them, as we've drawn attention to many times in Europe's eyes, the introduction of a massive Muslim-dominated nation into the EU. It changes the fundamental demographics of the EU, the composition of the EU. And they have said this is not in so many words, but this is a Christian entity here. The fact that that Turkey has actually taken that snub and gone further in the direction of radicalism, and Erdogan is he's no saint. I mean, that guy has really ruled his country with an iron fist and taken them in the direction of less freedom and more extreme views. But when you look at it from a pragmatic standpoint, it's not difficult to see why Germany would be so intent on keeping him in power when you look at it purely from a standpoint of what happens in Turkey if that place falls apart politically. You know, what all of these immigrants that are just flooding into that country, suddenly this becomes a problem many times worse.
Right, it could be a whole lot worse, and that's what Merkel's doing. And other European leaders, they're willing to just bet on this strongman and say that, well, if somebody can stop this flow, it'll be him. And we have to work with him or else we're going to be inundated with more people. And they're bribing Turkey with $3 billion. And who knows, if you start bribing somebody like this, it might go up to 4 or 5 or 6. Where's it going to stop? But they're willing to sacrifice just their core European values to get a political gain here. You wouldn't blame them for doing this.
They're in a difficult position. But what makes it so interesting is the fact that we have drawn attention to the prophecies of this alignment between Europe and Turkey, and we've been watching this situation to try to see where this is going to happen. Turkey continuing to to try to ingratiate itself with European leaders, Europe holding them at bay. There's never going to be a full union, but there's going to be enough that Turkey aligns itself in the end time prophecies, as we've drawn attention
to. Right. That's the most exciting thing about watching this take place, is that, as you say, we're trying to watch how you've got a predominantly Muslim nation that is going to align itself with a Christian Europe in a huge alliance that's going to take place from, you know, Northern Europe all the way down to the Saudi Peninsula. And Turkey's a key broker of this alliance. In the middle, right in the middle between, you know, the southern Islamic states and Europe. So watching them align just because of a relationship of convenience helps us see how that prophecy is coming alive.
Fascinating stuff. We'll definitely have to follow up on this and report on it. We need an article about this. It's really a really great story. These articles that we're talking about are in this week's Trumpet Weekly. Very informative, high-quality report each week with the most significant stories from around the world. We want to offer it to you for free. Subscribe to it by going online to thetrumpet.com. Receive the Trumpet Weekly every week in your email inbox. Coming up, we'll look at the important news from Europe and from Asia, and then later on, we'll have our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week. We're going to turn our attention now to events in Europe, and for that, we'll turn to Richard from our office in the UK. Richard, can you give us the overview of important headlines in Europe this week?
Once again, in Europe, it's all about immigration. That's what so much of the news today or this week revolves around. So one of the big parts of that is borders are coming up all over the place. Even Sweden closed their border yesterday between them and Denmark mainly, and they're checking people coming over on the bridges and on the ferries. And Sweden, for so long, has kind of been this bastion of pro-immigration. They've been really encouraging immigration for a long time, had wide open doors, and now even they're being forced to close their border. I think France was making some moves in that direction. It's getting close now to half a dozen European Union members have closed their border. And people are starting to ask questions now as to whether the Schengen area and this free travel within Europe can even survive. The other big news on that is Angela Merkel had some of her biggest challenges to her authority that she's seen in a long, long time this week. And that's actually the top story in Europe this week is an article written by, towards the end, I think it went up on Friday last week, by Mr. Stephen Fleury on exactly that subject. And just since he's written that article, there have been a whole load more developments. The finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, and the interior minister, Thomas de Maizière, these are probably the two most senior and most powerful ministers under Merkel, and they've both been opposing her immigration policy and have both been pushing back against that. So that's a significant development within German politics. And then finally, there was a big summit that EU leaders held on at Malta, where they tried to come up with some solutions to the crisis. And really, their main solutions involved throwing a bunch of money at Africa and throwing a bunch of money at Turkey and hope that fixed the problem.
All right. Well, your top story for this week, Richard.
My top story this week returns to a theme we've covered a few times at the Trumpet, and that is the German government has recently been forced to confront the number of Nazis that existed within the post-World War II government. And just to give some background to this, Mr. Armstrong, the managing editor of the Plain Truth, back in the 50s, back in the 60s, was writing articles talking about how the German government was infiltrated by Nazis, that a whole load of ex-Nazis had gotten senior positions within the German government, and not many people paid attention to that. But we're seeing more and more news coming out now from the German government showing that that was exactly right. So there's been an investigation in the finance ministry, in the foreign ministry, and now this week there is a report coming from studying the interior ministry. And that found that if anything, there are even more Nazis there than some of those other ones.
And can you just give us an idea of what does the Ministry of the Interior do? What are they responsible for?
Basically domestic security. So it's police, prison service. The UK equivalent would be Home Secretary.
So half of the executives in the Ministry of the Interior are Nazis. What does this mean? What are they doing, and how does this affect Germany at the time?
When this came up a year or two ago, Mr. Brad McDonald, one of our main correspondents over here, he actually went to Germany and interviewed one of the German journalists who was instrumental in exposing and getting a lot of these investigations started when the government didn't necessarily want to look into that, and exposing the number of Nazis that were working behind the scenes here. And in that interview, he had a whole bunch of great material until he got to, okay, well, what does that mean for Germany today? And at this point, this journalist's answers were kind of more like, well, not much really. They're just kind of carrying on as if this doesn't really mean anything today. It's merely a historical kind of curiosity, a bit of a shock. You know, what does that mean for the plans that Germany's been making? What does that mean for the things that have been going on within a lot of these ministries? And really, even to this day, a lot of that would still be very classified information.
You know, this article talks about just how after the war, not only were these people installed into power, but the number of senior ministers who had Nazi credentials actually increased, and it hit a peak sometime later. Can you just tell us about, say, what sort of timetable we're talking about here?
The article that we have in the Trumpet and the reports that bring this out, and these reports, by the way, are merely the intermediate reports. They're not the final product, so there could be more to come out here. But they show that the number of Nazis within the Interior Ministry was growing even into the 60s. So you're talking 15, 20 years after World War II, and not only are they still around, but actually there's more and more of them there.
You know, you mentioned at the beginning of the segment just how this points you back to the statements that Herbert W. Armstrong made after the war. He was so strong about the fact that the Nazi movement did not go away, and it was based on a biblical prophecy that talked about this powerful European empire actually being pushed underground and going underground, but then re-emerging at a later time. So we've definitely, really, it's been several revelations over the past 20 years or so that show just how accurate that assessment and how aligned with biblical prophecy the facts were about what happened here. We're getting more and more complete picture of really validation of some very strong statements that Mr. Armstrong made that a lot of people have gone back and they've criticized him for and said, well, you know, that clearly you look at the way that Germany has gone since then, and those were false statements that he made, but they were absolutely true.
Even I think the one that comes to mind most of all is he talked about how America left Germany to denazify itself. And then he talked about how this would lead to them. He tied that in with them going underground. And just to go back to some of these other revelations, there were even people working together to put together secret armies of ex-Nazis behind the scenes. There's still some debate going on about exactly whether people like Strauss, who was the German defense minister over a lot of this, how much exactly he knew of what was going on here.
You mentioned, too, about just how much people want to dismiss this history and say, well, this really has no bearing on current events. But isn't it interesting to view these revelations in light of these recent events within Germany and the response within the German people to the immigration crisis and some of the same kind of xenophobic, even nationalistic spirit that is rising, not within just the extremes of, you know, the skinheads and the blatantly neo-Nazi citizens, but the average guys, the average Germans who are simply responding to events. And there's clearly that same tendency. And you just wonder how much this kind of ideology within their senior leadership within these government positions still exists, that it filtered down into the populace, and that it does tell us something about the German mindset that is extremely relevant to today?
I think that's a really good point. I mean, to be honest, I was really surprised by some of the things that that Mr. McDonald brought out in his article that that was the Trumpet Weekly cover last week about that Hitler movie, and just brought out some of these sentiments. I think what this kind of shows after World War II is there was just this wanting to believe, as an ordinary German citizen, that it was not your fault, that it's not your people's fault, that it was a small cabal of people at the very top of the country who kind of kidnapped the country and turned things around, but that there was no broader problem. And that's the way I think a lot of that was painted. However, more and more history since then, not just these Nazi revelations, but just investigations into how were the prison camps run, what was the logistics of the Holocaust, etc., showed that this was not the case, and that there was a widespread support, or at least participation in some of those horrific crimes. But that's never really been addressed within the German public. And so a lot of these have been left unresolved, much as Germany makes a big show and has done, in some ways, probably a very good job, especially if you look at some of the things Angela Merkel has done in terms of apologizing for the Holocaust and reaching out to Israel. There have been some of these public displays like that from the top. This does really expose that repentance probably doesn't have much depth.
Thank you, Richard. You're listening to our Week in Review program. We'll turn now to Asia and to Jeremiah Jacques. We'll start with the overview.
A Chinese naval flotilla arrived in Cuba on Tuesday. That's 90 miles from United States soil. It was there to boost military ties between the two nations. Late last year, listeners will remember that U.S. President Barack Obama surprised the world by flinging open the doors to diplomatic relations with Cuba, and that was a dangerous move, a really short-sighted move. We've already seen Russia working with the terrible Castro regime there in Cuba, and now it's China's turn to show its support for that toxic Cuban government. News also broke this week about new weapons that Russia will soon deploy, which are capable of piercing the U.S. missile defense shield there in Europe. Russia hates that defense shield because it says it erodes Russia's nuclear deterrent. But now, if these reports about these new weapons are accurate, then Russia could pierce the shield, strike targets in Europe and beyond with nuclear weapons.
All right, and your top story from this week.
Well, top Pentagon officials are very concerned about Russia and China. They say there will soon be great power battles with these two Asian giants. And Pentagon officials say America needs to be strong and take really decisive action to just stand up to Russia and China. But the Obama administration disagrees. We have published an article in the Trumpet Weekly. This was originally in Bloomberg View, and it's called "The Pentagon's Lonely War Against Russia and China." It's a lonely war because the Pentagon is really alone in a sense. The White House and the State Department will not allow the Pentagon to fight this war or to really do much of anything to stand up to Russia and China. I'd like to read a quote from a speech that Defense Secretary Ashton Carter made last week. These remarks show that Carter is deeply concerned about Russia and China, and he wants to stand up to them. He said, "We do not seek to make Russia an enemy, but make no mistake, the United States will defend our interests, our allies, and the principled international order and the positive future it affords us all." So those are strong words, and many U.S. leaders, Republicans and Democrats alike, really praised Carter's remarks. He said, you know, they said that this was a sober assessment of a very real and growing power competition between the United States on one hand and then Russia and China on the other. But the problem is that the White House disagrees. So that means that these are empty words. Unless the Obama administration would back these measures to defend U.S. interests and those of our allies and everything else that Carter said, then it really wouldn't happen. And President Obama's track record shows that he really does not back those kinds of measures. We've got all kinds of really worrying examples of the division between the Pentagon wanting to take action and then the Obama administration preventing or seriously hindering that action. One example of that was that Carter has pushed to send lethal arms to Ukraine to stop the Russian invasion that's happening there. But the White House has repeatedly overruled those attempts. And then Carter has also said that Russia's military intervention in Syria is destructive, but the White House seems to almost welcome it. they've made outreaches to Moscow and just given no castigation at all. I would say one really worrying example of this happened in the South China Sea. That's where China has been illegally building islands, claiming all kinds of territory that doesn't belong to China. And so the Pentagon wanted to hold a freedom of navigation exercise there, just sort of wave the U.S. flag around, fly some aircraft, and just show China that America is strong and that it is standing up to these ridiculous and illegal claims. Well, the Pentagon waited on the White House to approve this exercise for months and months. And when the White House finally did approve it, they placed so many restrictions on the exercise that to the Chinese, it didn't even look like a freedom of navigation exercise. The U.S. ship wasn't allowed to turn on its sensors. It wasn't allowed to fly its helicopters. It really wasn't allowed to take any of the actions that would have made clear that the United States was conducting a freedom of navigation operation. And many analysts in China and the U.S. thought that it was not even a freedom of navigation exercise. They thought it was what's called an innocent passage exercise, which is far less confrontational. So many critics of the Obama administration said that the message to China was not clear at all. But I would say that Russia and China are getting a clear message. But it's the opposite of the message that we should be sending. They're getting the message that for as long as President Obama is in power, they can act with impunity. They can basically do as they please with little or no consequences. And the really worrying thing about this is that the Chinese leadership and the Russian leadership, they know that after President Obama leaves office in January 2017, then the situation could drastically change. They think that if someone like Donald Trump becomes president, then their season of license could come to an end. So they know that they have 14 months until that might happen, 14 more months of President Obama in office. So I think that what this means is that in these next 14 months, we could see some major pushes from Russia and China and others.
Hmm. It's hard to imagine them being pushier than they're being right now, but I imagine that you're probably right. There's a timetable there.
Yes, that's true. I think we'll see what happens.
Well, very interesting. We appreciate you bringing that to our attention. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories we're talking about on the program today are in that publication. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. Coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, starting with Brent.
At least 43 people were killed yesterday on Thursday and 240 wounded. And this is from two suicide bomb blasts that were claimed by the Islamic State Group. Now, this wasn't in Iraq, it wasn't in Syria, this was in Lebanon, in the capital city of Beirut, and specifically in a Shiite Muslim stronghold area dominated by Hezbollah. Now, this is one of the largest attacks that have taken place in Lebanon in years. The Islamic State said that they were going to strike Hezbollah inside Lebanon because Hezbollah has been fighting inside Syria since 2012, and they said, if you're going to fight over here, then it's free for us to go into Lebanon and strike you there. Now, this is a big deal because we've been watching for this to happen. We've been watching for this civil war in Syria to eventually spill over into Lebanon and upset what has been, you know, even though since 2006 we've had Hezbollah as part of the government, it has been relatively stable. You have had the odd attack between Sunnis and Shiites, but it's been relatively stable, and they've done their best, the Lebanese army, to hold that region of the anti-Lebanon mountains to keep the fight from coming over. But now with this attack, it looks like it might happen. So we do need to be watching Lebanon. There was a balance before the civil war started between Shiites and Sunnis. There, about 26% of the nation was either Shiite or Sunni. Now you've had 1.5 million Sunnis come over from Syria to upset that demographic. You've got Sunnis far outweigh the Shiite Hezbollah. So we could see things changing and turning for the worst for Hezbollah inside Lebanon.
All right, and now on to Richard.
This week, there's been yet more dramatic revelation about Germany's spying scandal. Angela Merkel, very famously, a year or two ago, said, spying among friends, that's just wrong. And that was when America was discovered to be spying on Germany and among a great many other nations. There was a big outcry at the time, lots of backlash against America. Relations between Germany and America soured. Over the past week, there have been a couple of dramatic revelations that showed that Germany was spying on way more people even than was previously thought. So the country's foreign intelligence agency was spying on the FBI. They were spying on U.S. arms companies and may well have been trying to steal industrial secrets. They were spying on the British. They were spying on the criminal court in The Hague. They were spying on the French foreign minister, Laurent Fabius. They were spying even on the World Health Organization. I'm not entirely sure what they were planning to gain from that. And so I think there's a couple of interesting things here. I mean, first is just this the breadth of German spying activity. You know, they're out there spying on the FBI. They're spying on German arms companies. The other thing that we've mentioned briefly before on this program is just the question, is Germany's foreign intelligence agency out of control? Which if they are, that's a bad thing. I mean, obviously, all politicians have kind of washed their hands of this. And if they're not, then it's even worse. It means that there's some very high-profile people within Germany telling them to go do this spying. So there's some big questions about Germany's intelligence agency and what they're doing at the moment.
Thank you, Richard. And now on to Jeremiah.
China recently conducted a flight test of a new missile capable of knocking out U.S. satellites. And this is a part of Beijing's growing space warfare arsenal. The test was of a Dongneng-3 exoatmospheric vehicle, and it was actually the eighth time that China has carried out one of these anti-satellite missile tests. The most disruptive of the eight occurred in January of 2007, when a Chinese missile destroyed one of China's own weather satellites, and that created a lot of debris that is still up there now, threatening all the satellites in orbit and even posing a threat to the International Space Station. So this is an alarming trend. The United States and Asian allies have protested all of these missile tests. Air Force Lieutenant General John Raymond has said, "We are quickly approaching the point where every satellite in orbit can be threatened by Chinese weaponry." And I just wanted to read a quote from an article by Richard Palmer. He wrote about this space race in March of 2012. He said, "For half a century, America was the world's dominant superpower. But evidence abounds in the nation's foreign policy, its economy, its military, and its scientific establishment that this period of dominance is ending. The realm of space technology is yet another area in which America's decline has set in, and foreign nations are closing the gap."
All right, thank you. Now on to Robert.
Well, China is quietly expanding its military influence in Africa. This week, a senior Chinese military official was in Djibouti, that little country on the opposite side of the Red Sea from Yemen in Africa. And this is a very strategic location because so much traffic flows in and out of the Red Sea. And reports are emerging that China may be attempting to establish a military base in Djibouti. There has not been an official announcement yet, but there is an unused port, and China has been making a lot of trips to this country. And I think this is something that bears watching closely. Here, once again, is another theater in the world where China historically has not had a presence, and yet we are seeing China becoming more involved in this region. So much of its oil comes out of the Middle East. So much of its trade to Europe goes this direction through the Suez Canal. And that Djibouti water route is so important. And this is something we'll expect more of, because historically, emerging economic powers translate into emerging military powers. And we are seeing this with China. As its economy has grown, it's becoming more involved in Africa. Earlier on, we reported about how China purchased so much land in the middle of, I think it was in the Congo, that the land they purchased there was the equivalent to the size of Belgium. So we're seeing their economic growth continue to grow, and we are seeing their military growth following along with that.
I just wanted to finish with a little story that came out. This Project Veritas group came out with another undercover video with a sequence of incidents where they went around college campuses around the country. They tell a college official that the Constitution is being distributed on the campus. And the reporter says something like, well, I didn't think this would happen, but I realized that the Constitution is kind of a trigger for me. I just really see it as an oppressive document. I mean, I'm scared to walk around campus and see the Constitution. Well, how did the university officials respond at a student who's afraid of the Constitution? They didn't say, look, get over it. You know, this is our founding document. You've got to start acting like an adult here. You know, there are people all over the world who would just do anything to live under the Constitution and the freedoms that it grants to us. No, they didn't say that. They said, we understand your pain. These people who are teaching our students all over this country, there are several quotes from the these videos. This one professor who, Wendy Kozol, she's a professor chair of comparative American studies at Oberlin College. She talked about the way that the Constitution and everyday life causes people pain, how there would be a lot of people that would agree that it needs to be destroyed. Carol Lasser, professor of history and Oberlin's director of gender, sexuality, and feminist studies, said the Constitution is an oppressive document. It makes change slow, and it intends to make change slow. They want things to change a whole lot faster. Colleen Cohen, faculty director of affirmative action and professor of anthropology at Vassar, said it's horrible that this is something that has caused you such pain. Can I destroy this? She said she'd put it through a shredder. And then on the video, you have Vassar's assistant director of equal opportunity seen shredding the Constitution there on that hidden camera. Cornell's Elizabeth McGrath shredded the Constitution. Syracuse's Sheila Johnson Willis cut it up with a pair of scissors. Yale's Jason Kilheffer actually used his bare hands to rip the Constitution to shreds. There were only two college officials, one at Duke University and one at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who defended the distribution of the Constitution and refused to destroy it. This is the same academic environment that is being required to defend sensitive students from hateful, provocative emails suggesting that people should be free to wear a turban on Halloween. They're so protective of cultural sensibilities, and they're so hostile to America's own history and its heritage and even its founding document, the document that protects our freedoms. We've talked a lot on this program and in the Trumpet magazine about how the left's lawlessness and its attack on the Constitution is bringing this country down. And here we see just how deep and how visceral their hatred is, where they're eager to literally tear it to pieces. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'd be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. That includes the stories that we've talked about on this week's program. We'd love to hear from you. Just email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Charles de Gaulle. Nothing great will ever be achieved without great men. And men are great only if they are determined to be so. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.